Blog Talk Radio.
Everyone. Hi, Justine.
Hi, Susan. How are you this evening?
I'm just fine. I appreciated those couple of minutes of sunlight we got today.
Yes, the sun was wonderful, wasn't it, after all that rain?
Rain, rain, rain. The rivers are raging.
Not
How about
that we're
you?
Complaining.
Nope.
Yep. Same here.
Well, I think we have
all
some
right.
questions to answer tonight, eh?
Well, we sure do, and most of you, of course, know Susan Weed quite well, but for those of you who don't, I'll offer a brief introduction. Susan Weed is an herbalist. She's also my mother, and she's the author of the acclaimed Wise Woman Herbal Series, which is a series of books that focus on women and health and herbs in the complementary, integrative, medicinal concept, which actually just seems to be coming popular now, but you've been writing about that for about the last 25 years, is that right?
That's right.
So,
I never wanted to be involved in a fight. I didn't see, you know, that there was like the orthodox medicine and then, you know, alternative medicine. And when I was first studying it, it was really put out to me as a fight that you either were involved in alternative medicine or you were involved in orthodox medicine. And people were really put down for, you know, if they went to an orthodox doctor, if they were involved in alternative medicine. That didn't make a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, there does seem to be a bit of misunderstanding between the camps. I mean, that even is happening now. I know there was some people who stayed with us, and one of them had a spider bite, and the other one wanted that one to go to the doctor, but she didn't really. So, you know, I offered some things, and she was really happy about that, and that made the other one, you know, not so hyper. But there were people at another table who were overhearing this. I gave her some clay and I gave her some echinacea tincture, and she knew how to use them, and she was very grateful to have those resources. But the woman at the next table asked me later, she said, so if you, you know, don't really have a primary care physician and, you know, like go to the doctor every time something's wrong, she says, what happens if you get cancer? And I said, well, what do you mean, what happens if you get cancer? She says, well, if you don't have a doctor and you get cancer, what happens? And I said, well, I said, let's start like right now. What would you do if you had cancer? What ways would you change your lifestyle? Why don't you start by doing that right now? I said, and then if you do get cancer, I said, at that time, you can make a decision what you want to do about that. If you want to, you know, go for Western medicine, great. If not, fine. You can have a lot of different options at your disposal, but you don't have to, you know, say yes or no to any particular thing. You should be as educated as possible and make a good decision that feels good for you personally. And she just was, like, surprised at that answer.
Yes. Also, I think perhaps even more to her point, if you are diagnosed by cancer, you're not going to be treated by your general practitioner. You're going
right.
to be sent to a specialist. You're going to be sent to someone you've never seen before.
Right.
So having a general practitioner that you go to on a regular basis is not really going to be as much use at all if you have cancer.
So it's apples and oranges. It's not even really related. But there was that fear of hers that if you don't have a doctor and you get really sick, then you're going to be out in the cold.
Yes, but of course,
but you have to pay your tithe. You know, you got to pay your tithe by going to your physicals and getting your tests and you know, doing that all along so that when you do get sick, when they do finally find that thing, they can take care of you.
Right, but in fact, that's not really how it works. although we would hope so, it simply isn't, because the medical treatment has been divided up into specialties. So, for instance,
uh-huh.
my sweetheart Michael, you know, who has cardiac issues, all his general practitioner said was, "You're going to die."
Oh my gosh.
Right, you're going to die, you're a heart attack waiting to happen, and other things like that. And it wasn't until he left the general practitioner and actually sought out a cardiologist that he got some, you know, real answers rather than just fear. And, you know, I often say that the scientific tradition runs of healthcare runs by fear. The heroic tradition of healthcare runs by shame and blame and guilt. And the wise woman tradition runs by self-acceptance and self-love.
That's great.
And that's,
I mean,
what you offered her. Instead of, she offered you fear, aren't you afraid? And you said, no, I feel self-confident.
Right. Right, of course. Yeah, I mean, yes, it's possible. Anybody could get sick anytime with something, you know, very serious. It's, you know, maybe environmental or hereditary, but it also could be just the luck of the draw or karma or whatever you want to call it, your soul's destiny. I don't know. But then, yeah, are you going to live your life in suspense of that moment is a good question.
Yes. Yes. Is it going to be helpful to you to have gone somewhere on a yearly basis? And I often ask people who recommends a yearly physical, and the answer is no one. Not the AMA. No one actually recommends a yearly physical, and many kind of smart doctors in the know say that the best way to stay healthy is not to go to the doctor on a yearly basis.
Yes, but the catch here is that the insurance company pays for those physicals. They pay for the wellness visits. They pay for a portion of the sick visits, but they will pay for those physicals and checkups because it is presumed that will keep you from getting sick.
No, it's not even presumed that it will keep you from it. What is presumed is that they will find it early.
Oh.
Right?
Yeah. I guess so. Right.
Because
anyhow, as you know and have pointed out so many times, the tests aren't always even accurate.
Exactly.
So,
yeah.
I think one of the reports that came out recently said that there was more harm done by the testing than good because of the inaccuracy of the results.
Yes, in fact, for a great many tests, that is absolutely true. And we need look no further than the test for cholesterol, one of the most common tests done in millions upon millions of people in the United States and throughout Europe and Canada are taking statin drugs based on a cholesterol test. And yet the cholesterol hypothesis is completely unproven. We simply cannot say that high cholesterol leads to heart attack. And the hypothesis that lowering cholesterol will reduce heart attack also has not been proven, and this is especially true when it comes to women. And, you know, I was just out in Wisconsin at the Midwest Women's Herbal Conference, and our dear friend Aviva Rahm was there, and somebody asked her, well, did you get your MD? Because she just, you know, got her MD license. Did you get that so you could change the system from the inside? She said, no, the system cannot be changed either from the inside or the outside. She said, but I got my license so that I could take people off drugs. And she says that's what she spends most of her time doing.
Wow.
It's convincing people. The drugs they've been prescribed, they don't really need. She said there is no woman who will ever benefit from taking a statin. And this, of course, is something that you've heard me say for over 10 years now.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. Consistently, you've been steering people away from the drugs when everybody else seems to be telling them to take at least something, you know?
So how wonderful that we have an MD out there who's saying, no, don't take that.
Well, and I think there's a lot of MDs like that. There's Carolyn Dean and Dr. Brown,
yes,
and Christiane Northrup, and you know, yeah, definitely. So I think
yes, and we do our best to bring those women's wisdom to our website. To Susan, we
yes.
do a great job of connecting with them, and we do seminars, teleseminars with them. So
your weekly radio show where you do interviews every week at Wise
every
Woman
week.
Radio, and that's every week
on
yeah,
Women's Radio,
hour,
right?
WiseWomanRadio.com. Anyhow, so I would like to. There were some people that wrote in and asked if they could have me read their questions because they're overseas or just don't want to call in too shy or whatever. I've printed
sure.
those out, and there are some interesting ones here. Shall we get started with that?
Yes, let's.
Okay, great. Here's the first one. Hey, I heard about you from a friend. I currently have osteoarthritis, and my hips are bone on bone, and they tell me I need a hip replacement. I don't want to. I'm looking into prolotherapy. Have you heard about that? Do you have any other ideas that could help me? My back and knees are also a problem. Thank you for your time.
Well, I'm glad that she knows that what's going on with her hips is also having an impact on her back and her knees. I have students and friends who have had hip replacements, knee replacements, shoulder replacements, and I must say that every single person who has done it has had one remark, and that is, why did I wait so long? I wish I had done this before I hurt other parts of my body. So it's not as though our hips are structurally separate. They are, as she noted, integral part of how we walk, how we stand, how we sit, how we lay. And when we have a condition in which there is inflammation and the fluids and the actual surfaces that are supposed to protect bone from bone wear away, then there is pain, and that pain, so far as I know, only gets worse and worse. I know that you know, Justine, that my Tai Chi teacher just recently had a knee replacement, but let's just go over his story a little bit. He's a very active person, 78 years old, teaches skiing and snowboarding, and uses his knees a lot, and he was in some pain with his knee, and he was in some pain with his knee, and he didn't want to get a knee replacement either, so he went for some other kind of therapy in which they said, well, first we can just inject some stuff in your knee, and that worked for a little while, and then the pain was more intense than it had been before, and then they said, well, we can go in and we can do like a kind of surgery where we go in and we kind of scrape around and make it smooth and inject some stuff in there. And he did that, and that worked for a little while, and then he was in more pain, and finally he did go and get the knee replaced. And again, his comment was, I wish I hadn't messed around with all that other stuff. I wish I just had gone right for the replacement and gotten the replacement, because there is, you know, I won't tease about it, there's a long recovery period. All right. And my brother had a knee replaced. He said it was 2 years. He felt for a recovery period. Our Tai Chi teacher said, you know, about a year. So it's going to vary from person to person. And certainly there are pain-killing herbs that can be used. There are herbs that can help to ease that. But are there any herbs that are going to make that synovial fluid come back? Are there any herbs that are going to make what's worn away come back? Not that we know of. There are not even any supplements that are going to make that happen. So it's certainly a very individual choice. And many people are astonished that I favor these kinds of replacements, but we've gotten very, very good at it, and they do save the rest of your body. Now, there's certainly a lot of things that we want to do before, during, and after the surgery, and comfrey infusion tops my list. Comfrey infusion does certainly help the joints. It helps the bones. It helps repair of all of those tissues when you decide to have the replacement done. And you can start drinking comfrey infusion at any point. A quart, up to 3 quarts of comfrey leaf infusion on a weekly basis will help to get one ready for surgery. Thinking about surgery, and a pretty big surgery like a hip replacement, it's not a bad idea to take some echinacea tincture beforehand as well. I used to be very much against the idea of taking echinacea on a regular basis, and we did have two people in the United States who did take it on a regular basis and then got into some trouble with it, anaphylactic shock, as a matter of fact, when they took a large amount. So I have somewhat changed my mind because I've been seeing some studies coming out of Switzerland in which they are getting very good results with having people take a kind of small daily dose of the tincture. Now, the two people who got into trouble were taking their echinacea in capsules. And I wonder if that was part of the problem. As you know, I'm pretty down on ever taking any herb in capsules. And the studies that have been done in Switzerland, they are using tincture of echinacea, which is what I favor as well. Also, not to overwhelm you with ideas here, but immediately after surgery, arnica is a tremendous ally for healing. You've had some incredible results with trauma and arnica. Eh, Justine? I know that my granddaughter, Monica Jean, took a tumble headfirst down a set of concrete steps. And, you know, before she even sat up screaming, of course, she had a knot on her head the size of a chicken egg. And I stayed with her. Justine ran and got the arnica ointment and put it on. And before we got her in the house, that egg had shrunk by half. And within an hour, it was completely gone. I mentioned my sweetheart, Nikki, and when he was in hospital having a triple bypass, I was actually out in California at my father's memorial service, but we got a friend who lived very near the hospital to go to him in the recovery room and put arnica gel on his feet. You don't even have to put the gel right where the trauma is. And he recovered so well and so quickly that when he went for his 6-week checkup, the doctor said, "I never want to see you again." I usually have people come for a 6-week, a 3-month, a 6-month, and then a yearly checkup, and you are healed better at 6 weeks than most people are after an entire year. So I know that my answer will be somewhat disappointing to you, that I am encouraging you to really consider that hip replacement, but I hope that the things I've shared with you will help you move through that in an easy way and a way that brings you optimum health.
Thank you, Susan, for answering that question and so thoroughly, and for offering some good supportive options too if she does decide to go for the surgery. You could offer some good herbal supporters, which is always nice to have that. Are you there?
I'm right here.
Hello? Oh, okay.
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, good. Wonderful. So I have another question for you, all right?
Sure.
Okay, great. This one starts with, "I was wondering if you can give me some information about my condition. I was considering taking chickweed for my PCOS, polycystic ovarian syndrome. I have also quite a few ganglion or fatty cysts. In addition, I'm overweight and I've had sinus problems for years. Would chickweed be good for me?
Well, let me start with a statement made by an elder male herbalist who is no longer with us. And in the first edition of his book, The Honest Herbal, Vero Tyler says, I didn't want to include chickweed in this book, but unscrupulous herbalists have forced me to do that because they are saying that chickweed is a medicinal herb, and it is not. And I can prove to you that chickweed is not a medicinal herb because it has never killed anyone. So, that said, I would say that chickweed is a wonderful herb for all of us. It certainly is a delicious, nourishing herbal infusion. However, in my book, Down There, Everything You Know You Need to Know About What's Below the Belt, The Wise Woman Way, while I've been talking, I have been looking through, and I do not see that chickweed is especially recommended. Not that it's disrecommended. Certainly no one would be harmed by using chickweed, but there is an entire and quite long chapter on polycystic ovarian syndrome. And, you know, I think the thing that's somewhat confusing is that it sounds like a poly, many cysts, you know, cysts on the ovaries syndrome. And yet, women with PCOS don't necessarily have cysts on their ovaries. So I understand that this woman is probably thinking, oh, I'll take chickweed to dissolve the cysts on my ovaries. But I'm unclear from her question as to whether or not she does have cysts on her ovaries. And this is a syndrome, and there are many, many, many symptoms. Weight gain, she says she's overweight. That is one of the most common symptoms of polycystic ovarian syndrome. Facial hair, infertility, irregular menses. These are the four main symptoms. Others include growth of body hair, dandruff, sleep problems, snoring, acne, pelvic pain, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, insulin resistance. As you can see, cysts on the ovaries are not even necessary to be diagnosed with this condition. So, again, I'm not really sure what's going on with her. Again, chickweed wouldn't hurt. It wouldn't be any problem if she wanted to take chickweed. But there would be a few much better things. So looking in my book now, under step 3, nourish and tonify, regular exercise. Regular exercise reduces the symptoms of polycystic ovarian syndrome, especially lowers depression. It reduces the risk of cancer. It reduces the risk of diabetes, all right? And, of course, if one is over one's desired weight, regular exercise is the best way to change that. So I would say that before chickweed, that certainly exercise should be looked into. Now, let me also say that when I say, wow, chickweed would be great for anybody, that would be chickweed infusion to dissolve real cysts in the ovaries. We're usually using chickweed tincture. Women with polycystic ovarian syndrome, I'm again reading from my book, do much better with a high-fat, whole-grain diet. Hormones are essentially fats, and so essential fatty acids are critical for women with polycystic ovarian syndrome, especially the omega-3 fatty acids as found in olive oil, butter, full-fat yogurt, cheese, nuts, fatty fish, purslain, and flaxseed. Avoid, however, the omega-6 fatty acids in vegetable oils. Avoid soy oil, canola oil, corn oil, cottonseed oil. And those kinds of oils can drive inflammation. In fact, of all of the things that I have talked to women about who have polycystic ovarian syndrome, this advice to get more high-quality fats in your diet has worked out the best for the most women. And one of the ways that I goal-oriented is make it your goal to have animal fat at every meal. Now, animal fat, again, includes fatty fish, it includes eggs, it includes butter, it includes full-fat yogurt, full-fat cheese, full-fat milk, all right? So there are a lot of ways to get that animal fat into your diet, And 3 or even 4 times a day is not too much for women with polycystic ovarian syndrome. Herbalist David Winston really likes jiakukau. In case you're wondering what jiakukau is, we call it self-heal or heal all. It's a scentless mint. The botanical name is Prunella vulgaris. And I always think of Prunella as being Cinderella's stepsister. You know, Prunella, Prunella, come down here and try on this glass slipper immediately. And especially with a second name like vulgaris, Prunella vulgaris. Self-heal or heal all. He makes a tincture of the fresh flowering plant, and it is in flower, coming into flower right now throughout much of the temperate zone. And so you can check out my YouTubes for information on how to tincture fresh herb or any of my books. Or he dries it and uses it as a strong tea with at least a tablespoonful of the dried herb, suggesting 1 to 2 cups a day or 1 to 2 dropperfuls of that tincture on a daily basis. So that might be something that our woman would want to look into. Of course, one of the things that I am most excited about for everyone is nourishing herbal infusions. And all of the nourishing herbal infusions, nettle, oat straw, and comfrey are fantastic for women with polycystic ovarian syndrome. I go easy on the red clover. I back down from 1/4 week to just 2 quarts a month. And if that seems to be disturbing, then none at all. But linden is one of the nicest anti-inflammatory herbs around. We put 1/2 ounce of dried linden flowers. They should be whole, not cut, in 1 quart of cold water. Bring it to a boil. Turn it off. Cover the pot. Let it steep for about 4 hours. And you will get a wonderful anti-inflammatory effect, because remember that most of the problems going on with polycystic ovarian syndrome have to do with inflammation. However, let's remember what Dr. Mary Enig, nutritionist, says. She says that if you substitute soy for meat or dairy, it is going to increase your distress from polycystic ovarian syndrome. She points to a statement made by Dr. Naomi Baumslag, who's the president of Women's International Public Health Network, who says the amount of phytoestrogen in soy products varies by as much as tenfold. And the soy used today that you are being sold, especially for soy beverage, which some people call soy milk, has 10 or more times more isoflavones than ordinary soy. So this is definitely a problem with women with polycystic ovarian syndrome. I also, as we go on into step 4, we talk about 3 very important herbs: saw palmetto, which has androgen modulating effects; chasteberry, which is also known as Vitex, which is especially helpful for women with PCOS; and fenugreek tea. A cup a day of great-tasting fenugreek tea really helps if you have prediabetes or even diabetes, and this is type 2 diabetes. And I usually put anywhere from 6 to 8 teaspoonsful of fenugreek seed into a quart jar, add 1/4 of boiling water, but I don't brew it for more than 20 minutes because it can get bitter. You can stop anywhere between 5 and 20 minutes, strain it out, I refrigerate it. I love to drink this during the summertime because it makes your perspiration smell like maple syrup.
Well, that's nice. Maple syrup. Nobody could be
offended
by that.
Yeah, makes you smell really good.
So I wasn't quite sure if you were done with that or
yes. Well, it's a little hard for me because I don't have the person to question to say, well, what is it you're concerned about? Do you have cysts on your ovaries? Why were you attracted to the chickweed? So sometimes I feel like I might be missing really addressing the actual question that the person had, but I'm hoping that I'm giving them enough information here and enough places to look for more information. Check out my book down there. There's an entire chapter on PCOS.
Right. And did you answer the thing about the fatty cysts and the ganglion?
I'm not exactly sure what that is and in which ganglion it is, because there are ganglia throughout the body. So, again, this is a place where I wish that I had the person so that I could get more information from her, because I don't have enough information to make any kind of answer to that.
Right. Well, maybe after a while people will start to get more brave and call in instead of email.
Yeah, she's listening and she'll write more in. Even next week, that's fine. We have long memories. Yep. We can do that.
Okay, very good. Okay, so the next one is kind of a long email here. And she says, "Hello, I am from Germany, Nuremberg. I love all the resources at your website. Thank you so much. I have your book, Healing Wise. I am excited about your new radio show. And thank you so much for letting me ask my question by email. I'm going to give it a try, but I don't know. I don't think I could call in, so I will give you my email question. My brother just recently got diagnosed with Crohn's disease. He has an inflammation and an abscess in his colon and is taking antibiotics and cortisone to reduce the inflammation. Doctors say if the inflammation doesn't go down in a few weeks, the colon inflamed piece needs to be removed surgically. From the information I have gathered, my first thought was to give him linden infusion to help fight the inflammation. My brother is very willing and open to tackle this whole thing with the help of herbs and nutrition, since what he heard so far about it makes a lot of sense. My question is this: am I right with the linden infusion, and what else would you recommend? Can herbal medicine help with this, even though he is on the other medications, which he seems to have to take in this acute state of the disease, and he can only reduce them gradually, at least the cortisone? It would be wonderful if you could address this topic on your show. Thank you very much. Love and blessings."
Well, I just mentioned that I was out in Wisconsin at the Midwest Women's Herbal Conference, and that my friend Aviva Rahm, who's an herbalist and midwife and an MD, was there. And we were talking about the new research that's coming out about what happens when children are given antibiotics. And we are finding that there's some very severe repercussions, and that those repercussions are not immediately obvious. But we are finding, when we look back at the records, that children who are given antibiotics during their first year of life double their lifetime risk of developing Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. And so the very first thing I would say is off the antibiotics, because it's quite possible that antibiotics cause the Crohn's disease in the first place. Now, certainly it's not the only thing, but we are tracking down a pretty hot scientific trail here showing that it is the disruption of the gut flora that triggers ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease and other situations in which our only response is to give more antibiotics and or, as she says in her letter, to cut that piece of the intestine out, which then would require massive amounts of antibiotics because of the surgery, which to my mind and to Dr. Aviva Rahm's mind simply makes the problem worse and worse and worse. And Monica Jean, our delightful Monica Jean, who's 5.5 years old, would be able to tell this woman exactly what to use, because it's one of Monica Jean's favorite herbs, and that is slippery elm. And there is a wonderful YouTube of Monica Jean making slippery elm balls. And slippery elm balls are really easy to make. One of the first people that I ever know with Crohn's disease actually drove up on a motorcycle, roared up on a motorcycle going so fast, I thought she was going to drive right into the house and not wearing a helmet. And I thought, my goodness, does this person have a death wish? And then when she told me that she had terrible, severe Crohn's disease and that she had already had a great amount of her intestine removed, I began to understand why she was driving her motorcycle so fast and not wearing a helmet. that. I didn't approve, but I began to understand. And I talked to her about slippery elm, my go-to herb for any digestive problem. And we made some slippery elm balls, and she tried them, and she said, oh, no, 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 no. This is simply not going to work. I cannot stand the taste of slippery elm balls. And anybody who's ever had one is scratching their head at this moment and going, what? Wait, slippery elm balls taste really, really good. What's her problem with it? Well, her problem with it is that it reminded her of the taste of the opaquing agent that they made her take when they x-rayed her intestines. And it was just too weird for her to have that taste in her mouth. So she did a rather interesting thing. She got some, I usually use a slippery elm bark powdered because it's easier to put into food and roll up into balls that way. But she got some actual slippery elm in her bark, and she made a tincture of it, and she took the tincture. And within 6 months, her Crohn's disease was completely gone, and the doctors suggested that she go back into surgery and have her intestines hooked back up. And I could go on with example after example, and 6 months seems like a long time, but remember that this woman had already had surgery to remove her intestine because it wouldn't even respond to cortisone. So this was pretty remarkable to her and the doctors. Other people whose Crohn's disease is not so severe and not so entrenched have actually responded sometimes as quickly as a week of using slippery elm balls. Slippery elm ball is a safe, nutritive food. We can use it in any quantity. There is no overdose possible. And it can be taken at the time when there's pain, or it can simply be taken because we want to take it. As I said, we can add it to our food. I know a couple of months back at the E-Zine, and I know we archive the E-Zines, I had lots of rule of recipes for putting slippery elm into various combinations for oatmeal. And slippery elm and astragalus, of course, is one of my favorite combinations, and especially for people who are dealing with intestinal problems. This slippery elm soothes the intestines. The astragalus acts to nourish and build up the immune system, because often with these autoimmune diseases, we actually do need to nourish the immune system. It sounds a little backwards. You know, you think, wait a second. This is caused by an autoimmune disease, and that means my immune system is attacking me, so the immune system must be hyped. It must be too stimulated. I would want to sedate or calm down the immune system. But actually, I liken this to the condition that a child can get into where they're so exhausted that they start running around screaming and banging into things. And you say to a child like that, oh, you're very tired. Of course, they're going to scream at you, I am not tired. Right, and that's, I think, what's going on with the immune system, that we have an immune system that is so exhausted that it actually starts eating our own guts, taking out our own thyroid, doing damage to our own pancreas, and that by nourishing the immune system with safe, nourishing things like echinacea, astragalus, Siberian ginseng, schisandra, and these are some world-class immune system tonics and nourishers, and then we can calm the immune system down just as we take that child, hold that child in our arms, rock them, sing to them, kiss them, and then they are able to relax. Linden is certainly a good idea. All of the nourishing herbal infusions provide wonderful nutrition. One of the things that is really a concern for me when I'm dealing with somebody who has any kind of gut issue, whether it's Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, irritable bowel syndrome, or just kind of, woo, weird gut, is that the nutrition that we need to really heal that isn't getting through that damage. It's kind of like I'm driving on the thruway and the traffic is slowing down. There's an accident, but it's on the other side of the road. It's not on my side, and yet everybody's slowing down on my side, which clogs up the traffic there. So we want to get the nutrition into the tissues, and the nourishing herbal infusions are one of the best ways that I know to get that nutrition into the body. Nourishing herbal infusions, because they are made with dried herbs and boiling water, are absolutely safe for people with digestive problems. Somebody with Crohn's disease certainly should stay absolutely away from raw foods, raw food juices, green juices, those kinds of things can actually kill someone in this kind of state, whereas the nourishing herbal infusions bring lavish amounts of protein, vitamins, and minerals into the body and help the body to begin to repair itself. And I would be a little negligent if I didn't mention an herb that many herbalists use frequently whenever there is inflammation, especially in the gut, and that is marshmallow root. No, we're not talking about the marshmallows that you go and buy in the store, although those were originally actually made out of sugar and marshmallow root, which is a kind of slippery, mucilaginous root. But the actual root of the marshmallow plant, which you can buy, and you make it much like the cold water infusion that I just mentioned for the linden. Put about half an ounce of marshmallow root into a quart of cold water, bring it up to a boil, put a lid on it, let it steep for 4 hours, and that can be drunk as a daily beverage like the slippery elm balls. It is a nutritive. There's no overdose possible. I know that these things will be helpful for your brother, and thank you for being such a loving sister for writing in and asking for ways that the two of you can work together to help him.
Oh, thank you, Susan. Thank you. There's a P.S. on this, by the way, and it says, P.S. I tried to get a hold of slippery elm, but it seems the only source I can get it from is through animal food and medicine online shops. It's not offered for humans, it seems, at least in Germany. Should I get it anyway?
Yes.
Okay, very good. Here is the next question from a concerned cat owner. My cat had a sliver or other foreign matter in her right middle front toe. I took her to my regular vet. The vet squeezed out the foreign matter and some pus, but she gave her an antibiotic shot. She had a follow-up appointment a week later, and it hadn't improved. The vet then prescribed 10 days of Xenakin tablets and vetercycline VF rubbed into the wound. We finished the round of antibiotics, but the toe has not improved. The vet sent a culture to the lab, and the result came back as actinomycosis bacterial infection. She wants me to put my cat on a different antibiotic, which will be taken twice a day, and if this doesn't work, amputate the toe. Can you please recommend an alternative that might help? Any advice would be greatly appreciated. Thank you.
Yes, let's talk about this. I want first to say how much it would please me if people would work their way through the 6 steps of healing. In every one of my books, if you have any of my books besides the green book, it's the only book it doesn't appear in the very beginning part of the book, you will find a section called the 6 steps of healing. We were looking in down there, and here it is in down there. But again, it's in the breast book, it's in the menopause book, it's even in the childbearing year book. So the very first step is do nothing. Now, certainly in a situation where the cat seems to have an infection, do nothing doesn't sound like a reasonable thing. But what I mean by nothing is different than don't do anything. Do nothing, and I have friends who work on ambulance crews, and they say, when I get to the scene of an accident, if I do not take time to do nothing first, then I will not do what I need to do. I must get out of the ambulance. I must stand absolutely still. I must breathe deeply. I must open myself, and then I know where to go first. So doing nothing does not have to go on for a very long time, but it's that still and quiet inner space that we come to rather than rushing off in a panic. So we sit with our cat and we say, "Cat, what is going on? How can I help you?" And start to collect ourselves and bring ourselves to a place where we can hear the healing. The step after that is collect information. And in this instance, we could say, Is the cat's foot hot to the touch? That would indicate infection. Is it redder than usual? That would indicate infection. Is there pus there? That would indicate infection. So these are three very simple things that we can see. If we have all three of those things, then we have pretty acute infection. And certainly that would bring with it inflammation as well. One of the easiest things to do if there is inflammation and infection, especially at an extremity like a hand or a foot, is to soak it. And hot water is a perfectly adequate soak. If you want to make it more medicinal, throw a handful of salt into that hot water, and that will actually help draw out infection. One of my nurse friends says the very best soak for any kind of infection on the hand or the foot is Ivory dish washing soap. She says it can't be any other. It has to be Ivory. And I know that I have tried this, and there is something very different about the Ivory. I don't know if there's a different surfactant in it or what it is, but it really opens up anything that's infected and allows it to drain out. And so that's as hot as can be tolerated for a human. For a cat, that would not be very hot. But if the cat isn't feeling well, often you can wrap the cat up, put the cat in your lap, and then just hold their paw in that hot soapy water or that hot salt water. I've also done soaks with seaweed in it because seaweed also softens and draws out infection. There's a great variety of things that can be done if the cat, and cats vary, if the cat simply would never tolerate having her paw get wet that way, then grating up summer squash like zucchini and packing that onto the infected area will often draw the infection out within the hour. I don't know if you remember, Justine, but there was one summer where I had been teaching at a big conference, and somebody got into some trouble, and they asked me to run and help her, and I did run, and I came down really hard on something in the grass, and I tried to get it out of my foot when I got home and was quite unsuccessful. And I was really limping and trying to get this thing out of my foot. It was a real misery. And I said, okay, so here's what I'm going to do. I'm just going to explore poultices. I'm going to explore drawing poultices. And I started reading up on all the drawing poultices there were. And I started trying them. And it actually took me close to 30 days to get it. It was a piece of glass shaped like a little arrowhead out of my heel. And it was up at the side of my heel, not, unfortunately, at the very bottom of my heel. And so I tried a great number of different poultices, and the summer squash was the most drawing, especially the patty pan squashes. They're not on the market yet, but in most places you can get yellow squash or zucchini squash, and cucumber as well. You may notice if you cut those things up, like if you're cutting up summer squash for cooking it, that your fingers get really kind of dehydrated and with kind of a funny skin on them, and that's that drawing effect from that, so that could also be used. I would use echinacea tincture along with antibiotics. I don't have any problem interfacing both of those. And, you know, this is kind of where my heart, like, kind of fell, you know, down when she said, well, I took the cat to the vet, and the vet gave her a shot of antibiotic. I'm like, ah! Because that's all the way down at use drugs, right? And we're still up here at collect information, engage the energy, mind medicine, prayer, homeopathy, visualization, right? All kinds of things that we can do. We used to really benefit from a woman in the area. Hey, we miss you, TJ, who did Reiki. And she would come over. You know, I had some pretty traumatic things happen to my cats over the years. And she would come over and she would do Reiki with the cats. As a matter of fact, one of my cats was run over by a car, and her pelvis was broken into 20 pieces. And we refused surgery, and we basically, you know, although we took her to the vet and got an x-ray, so we knew it was broken in 20 pieces, we didn't want to do any of the things that the vet wanted to do. So instead, we gave the cat comfrey leaf infusion with raw goat's milk, and she was accompanied by an apprentice or myself 24 hours a day. We had a rota, and somebody was always there with her and always offering her milk and echinacea and comfrey infusion for her healing. And then, you know, we had this wonderful woman come over and do Reiki 2, 3, sometimes even 4 times a day in the very early part of that. So if you don't know Reiki for helping your cat, I'm sure there are other people who do, probably even someone who's a friend of yours who would be willing to do some of that for you. And then nourishing and tonifying, when I'm talking about my cat who was run over, we gave her comfrey leaf infusion mixed with milk because we really wanted to give her a lot of nourishment. And that nourishment doesn't have to be that. That nourishment could also take the form of buy your cat some liver and cook some liver for her and give her that. Cats love liver. It's a very important food for them. And if you have your cat on any kind of restricted diet, in other words, if you're trying to make your cat vegetarian, now is the time to give this up and see it for the nonsense that it is. Cats are carnivores. They need meat in their diet. They can do very well on a diet that is mostly kibble with a little meat, but they do need some meat. And if your cat hasn't been getting that, this is definitely the time to start doing that. These first four steps always build health. Doing nothing, collecting information, engaging the energy, and nourishing and tonifying. The next three steps are good for acute situations, but they actually do erode health. So the next step is to stimulate and sedate rather than antibiotics. I would much, much rather than antibiotics give any animal echinacea. Now, echinacea I do use as a tincture, and cats don't do well with tinctures. Cats don't do well with alcohol at all. And yet when my cat had a broken pelvis, we very much wanted her to have some echinacea, so we mixed it in with milk. And we find that a little bit of tincture mixed in with milk, most cats will freely accept, or it can be put in a dropper and put right into their mouth and get a plastic dropper so the cat bites down on it and doesn't break the glass dropper. You can often get those at drugstores. And we have found with lots and lots of cats that there have been no adverse effects from using tinctures in milk. So long as we're giving the cat the tincture in milk, that's just fine. So you could use echinacea right along with that antibiotic, or you could segue away from the antibiotic. And then, after we have tried all of that and none of that has worked, only then would I say use antibiotics. So, you know, I do understand that this is how many people operate. And surely in modern medicine, they are pretty much only using the last two of these steps, which is use drugs and break and enter. And that's exactly what the veterinarian has suggested to her. Use drugs, use more drugs, use stronger drugs. And if that doesn't work, then break and enter, amputate that toe. I don't think that that's what's going to be needed here, but I would appreciate it if you could get back in touch with us in a couple of weeks. Let us know what you used, if it worked or not, and how your cat is doing, because now we're involved and we want to know.
Thank you. Thank you for that comprehensive response, which could be really helpful to lots of different people in lots of different situations. You there?
I'm right here.
Yeah. It can be scary when you don't know what to do and you go to the doctor and the doctor doesn't really give you that many options. It's either A, antibiotics, or B, another antibiotics. And if that doesn't work, well, let's just cut it off. That doesn't give you a whole lot of options, does it?
No, it doesn't.
That's kind of scary when you don't have any other ideas about what to do. So folk medicine or herbal medicine is so comforting to give people at least some empowerment.
Absolutely.
And not only that, but that, as you pointed out, most of the time these gentler solutions are actually more effective.
Exactly. I'm certainly, you know, not against antibiotics. There are definitely times when that is the most useful thing to do. What just kind of makes my heart sad is when we try that first rather than trying the gentler but just as effective options before we do that.
Right. Well, if you go to the vet, that is trying that first for the most part, unless you go to a holistic vet.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's why I want to see herbal medicine become people's medicine again, so that we understand that we can work with these things before we go to the professional.
And that will really...
Who is going to be limited in what they have to offer.
And it'll ease the burden on the medical system as well.
Exactly.
So people will not be going in there with trivial concerns, really, but for things that are really quite serious and need that strong Western impact.
Just right.
Yep. All right. Well, I have a few more questions here. Let's see here. Okay. She says, hi, Susan. I was reading some of your website on Chasteberry. And I want to know about black cohosh root extract, because I have clinical depression. I need to be careful. Can you help me? I really appreciate it. I am anxious, but willing. Thank you.
I don't understand the question.
So what I'm reading here is this woman is in menopause and wants to use Chasteberry and black cohosh root, but she's concerned that either of those herbs might have a negative effect on her because of her history of depression.
Okay, let's look in new menopausal years the wise woman way and see what we can find out about those herbs. Black cohosh, a stately and striking perennial plant of hardwood forest that has been so over-harvested that I can now walk for an entire day in its prime habitat and see only a few small groups of it. Native Americans have long considered it a powerful ally for menopausal women, and science agrees. Numerous studies show black cohosh tincture can be as effective as hormones in relieving common menopausal problems, including hot flashes, headaches, joint pain, water retention, and fatigue. Right? Recent analysis finds that black cohosh does not suppress luteinizing hormone and contains no compounds related to estrogen. Thus, the science at the time when this book was written believed that this could be safe for women who have a diagnosis of breast cancer. Now, the opinion has changed about that, and the opinion is now that it is not safe, but that's science for you. The science is the system which is open to change, and so we can't get upset with it for changing, and that might change back again. I personally don't recommend using black cohosh because of the over-harvesting. Let's look at the cautions. Do not use black cohosh if you have menstrual flooding, if you could be pregnant, or if you are breastfeeding. Large doses can cause flushing, low blood pressure, or slowed heartbeat. Primary side effects, headache, dizziness, visual disturbance, and nausea are common and more severe with preparations made from dried root. So in terms of her question, could I use black cohosh, or is it counterindicated for someone who has depression? There is no contraindication for anyone who has depression. And in fact, black cohosh is said to invigorate the chi and help the nerves. It has been praised as a remedy for hysterical women, women who are easily agitated, women who are easily upset. Now, that's not necessarily depression, but we can see that it's not causing depression or promoting depression in any way at all. Again, however, I do not recommend the use of black cohosh for menopausal women. In fact, let me take a step back from this altogether and say that there is no herb that I recommend for menopausal women, because menopause is not a problem that needs to be treated. And I think this is why I didn't understand what the question was, because to me, nothing needs to be done for menopause. You're in menopause, and like giving birth, yeah, there's going to be some pain, there's going to be some disruption, But the pain of labor is not a problem that we try to get rid of. The pain of labor is what's supposed to be going on. And just so, some waking up at night, some hot flashes, some sleep disturbances, some crying when you see babies, these are all just kind of part of the scene of menopause, just like labor pain is part of giving birth. So I wouldn't necessarily go running out and take any herb because I was in menopause. Chaste berry, also called vitex, and Chinese herbalists use the dried berry-like fruits of this small tree. In fact, they've been used by menopausal women since antiquity. For today's woman, whether she is going through menopause naturally or whether she's had surgery, radiation, or drugs, chaste berry can help smooth the way. During the early menopausal years, vitex can help keep the cycles more regular. Later on, vitex is especially useful for women who decide that they do want to become pregnant. Vitex is a legendary anti-aphrodisiac to men, and that's why it's called chaste berry or monk's pepper. However, oops, it can be an aphrodisiac for some women. It may make him droop, and it may make you horny. But whatever way you're going, up or down, vitex is definitely affecting your glands. It can calm down severe hot flashes, counter dizziness, improve your chances of having a baby in your 40s, reestablish menstruation that has stopped prematurely, reduce and eliminate menstrual cramps, PMS, endometriosis or fibroids, stop flooding, spotting, oozing, and irregular cycles, redirect hysteria into focused action and emotional calm, clear hormone-related skin problems, and a whole bunch of other stuff. Let's get down to the cautions. In use for over 2,000 years in North Africa, vitex has a reputation for being free of side effects. Physician herbalist Tiarona Lodog, MD, says she has seen vitex in capsules trigger a rash in a few women. So again, there is certainly no reason not to take vitex, and being depressed would not mean that vitex would either, you know, make you more depressed or even relieve the depression. But that said, I would not recommend vitex or black cohosh for anyone going through menopause just because you're going through menopause, any more than I would recommend any herb for somebody for going through puberty just because you're going through puberty. However, obviously, and of course, we know what Susan recommends. Susan recommends drinking a quart of nourishing herbal infusion every day. Whether you're in menopause, before menopause, or after menopause, a quart of nourishing herbal infusion every day will help whatever is happening to you happen in a way that is going to promote health rather than making you feel that your health is being taken away from you. A quart of nettle infusion, the next day a quart of oat straw infusion, the next day a quart of linden infusion, the next day a quart of red clover, the next day a quart of comfrey leaf. That's what I do. I rotate through those five nourishing herbal infusions I did during my menopausal years, I did before my menopausal years, and I have continued to do that in the 20 years since my last period. Again, my book, New Menopausal Years, The Wise Woman Way, gives you information on working with these infusions and hopefully reassures you that menopause is not going to last forever. In fact, herbs like vitex and red clover, which have a hormonal effect, can actually, for some women, worsen their menopausal symptoms. So if you're going to use these, be sure that you use the tincture. Be sure it's the tincture of the fresh plant, and use just one, not both, until you really get into a groove and a rhythm with it and know that you're happy with it. Because if there's going to be a side effect, you don't want to be using two herbs, because you want to be able to tell right away which one it is that is causing you a distress or side effect if you are getting that from any of these herbs. Check out New Menopausal Years, The Wise Woman Way, and I think that you will find yourself feeling a little easier about what's going on.
Thank you. Thank you for that. I have someone on the line. I'm not sure if they want to ask a question or not, but might as well take a pause here and offer that to them. The person in the 250 area code, do you have a question for Susan?
Hello?
Hi. Do you have a question for Susan? Because if
I'm just listening here, but one love.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. Enjoy. Okay. There is, looks like someone else who's raised their hand here, so let me get into that and unmute. In the 646 area code, are you there?
Yeah.
Hi. Do you have a question for Susan?
I do. I was recently diagnosed with dysplasia, the HPV, up in the vaginal canal. They want to do the LEAP procedure to cut because it's too far advanced to do the freezing cryosurgery. So I'm wondering, I saw a naturopath when I was in another state, and she said there was a protocol she did with vaginal packs over 12 weeks that cured this, and I was wondering what I could do, but it's not, I live in New York State, so I don't have anyone here, and I was wondering if there's anything I could do naturally to instead of doing the surgery.
There certainly are things that you can do rather than doing the surgery. And again, I'm looking in my book down there, and I hope that you have a copy of this book because it talks about healthy cervix, and then it talks about cancer and what to do before you agree to surgery. Any fast-growing or abnormal cells could be or could become cancer. That's why you're going to be urged to have surgery to remove your cervical tissue, your genital warts, or your dysplasia. Give yourself time to try successful alternatives. Surgical procedures, including endometrial biopsy, DNC, aspiration extraction of the contents of the womb, radiation implants, cone biopsy, cryosurgery, laser ablation, and various packs done by naturopathic doctors can actually cause cervicitis, cervical erosion, especially if there is a concurrent but untreated infection. Human papilloma virus is possibly one of the most misunderstood viruses that we are currently dealing with. The human papillomavirus is the most common sexually transmitted disease in the world, with more than 6 million new cases a year in the United States. The Center for Disease Control says that at least 50% of all sexually active people will be infected at least once over their lifetimes. During a 3-year study, 40% of a group of female college students got a human papillomavirus infection. In other words, over the 3 years of the study, 40% of women in the study got HPV. This does not mean that you have to have surgery to deal with it. Let's continue to look here and move into pap smears. And I have a little chart here. And could you tell me again what the exact diagnosis was so that I can look it up in the Bethesda classification list here?
Well, it was a HPV high-risk strain, and that it was the dysplasia was in the vaginal canal, and it was they diagnosed it as what they call stage zero cervical cancer, so pre-cervical cancer kind
zero.
Of thing.
Zero. Oh, my goodness. You know, this is
I know.
Really.
I know.
Stage zero.
I know.
It's like,
stage zero.
You know,
I didn't know what that meant.
That means
so
you don't have. Do you know what
well,
it means? It merely means unusual cells, and it's very common.
Dysplasia means unusual cells?
All it means is unusual cells.
Okay, because they really do the scare thing. And he said, well, you've got to really schedule this right away, and you should get the surgery right away. And I thought, well, wait, you know, what? Can I do something else? And can my immune system heal it?
Of course you can do something else.
I had it a few years ago, and like 4 years ago, and I cleared it myself because I went back. The gynecologist had come back in a year for the colposcopy, which I kind of would like to stop doing also because they cut every time to do a biopsy. But,
Wait a second. Excuse me. Let's just be clear here. The colposcopy does not involve cutting. They are doing they are taking tissue, which is a different procedure. The colposcopy is just looking.
Oh, okay. So they're taking tissue. I forget what that's called then.
Taking
that's what
tissue.
They
like they're taking their tissue sampling at the same time. But that
yes.
is not the colposcopy. A colposcopy, it's like if you say, I don't like putting my glasses on because somebody takes a piece out of my nose every time I put my glasses on.
Oh, I see. I gotcha.
Putting your glasses on doesn't involve taking a piece out of that's somebody else there who's taking a piece out of your nose.
So you can have
colposcopy and refuse to have a piece taken out of your cervix.
Oh, great.
Thank you.
Okay. I did read something recently that a doctor in India, they were doing something with vinegar and just like, you know, because it would bubble instead of cutting or taking a piece of tissue.
No, you're misreading that.
Okay.
Vinegar is used to diagnose.
Yes.
But only to diagnose.
Right.
It's not a treatment.
It's a diagnostic tool.
The lesions, they're called lesions, when vinegar is on them, become white so you can see them.
Right. So I was just rather having that instead of him taking tissue. I thought that would be
The doctor is not going to do that. You're going to have to get a speculum and do it yourself if that's what you want to do.
Okay, well, I was just wanting to test. Well, I do want a way to check to see if it is gone. I would like a natural way to treat it. And I do want to tell you one other thing. When I said to him, you know, I did clear it a few years ago by my, you know, strengthening my immune system. And I know I've been through a lot of stress in the past few years. And I lost my mom and, you know, was her caregiver through cancer. But he said, oh, you're 50. You're too old for that. You can't possibly clear it on your own. So,
that sounds fairly ageist to me.
Yes, it was horrible to hear. First the cancer scare and then telling me that I was too old to trust my body to heal itself if I, you know, so I dismissed it.
It's a rather
really
outrageous suggestion. Find a different doctor. This one does not sound very useful. Help.
Yes.
Cervical dysplasia. This is on page 191. Do you have down there?
I don't, but I will get it.
Good. You need it. Page 191,
okay.
Help. Cervical dysplasia. Eat more red, orange, and green foods well-cooked at every meal. If I was looking at something like what you're looking at, believe me, I would not be eating any raw food of any kind. I would make sure that my food was cooked so that I could get good nutrition. I would broaden my diet. What's your diet like? How would you characterize your diet?
Actually, what's interesting is I started to do more alkaline foods and doing blended vegetable drinks and raw, and I actually felt a lot better.
Very bad idea.
Okay, that's confusing because it's so highly spoken of, and I
not
do
really
feel
that
better.
Confusing.
I mean,
let's do a little thought experiment here, okay? I'm going to give you two sunflower seeds to plant. One of them is a sunflower seed that's in the shell, and it's raw. And the other one is a roasted sunflower seed. And you're going to plant those sunflower seeds. You're going to be kind to both of them. You're going to plant them just the right depth. You're going to plant them in a really good sunny place, and you're going to water them well. And in this thought experiment, can you tell me what is going to happen to those two seeds?
I'm guessing the roasted one may take, because it doesn't have the shell covering it, and would be able to take the nutrition in from the soil.
Seeds don't take in nutrition.
Okay.
So you don't garden?
No, I don't.
Okay. Usually when we plant a seed, it grows, yes?
Yeah.
Okay. So the raw seed grows. It sprouts and grows. But the roasted seed does not.
Okay.
What happens to the roasted seed that does not grow?
I guess it's absorbed into the earth.
Okay. What's the process by which it is absorbed into the earth? That's the right answer, but what's the process that allows that to happen?
Some kind of decomposition, I'm guessing.
That's right. Kind of decomposition. And decomposition means that seed is being eaten by soil microbes.
Mm-hmm.
So which seed was eaten by the soil?
The roasted one.
And which one was not edible?
The shell, the one in the shell.
The raw one.
The raw.
nothing in nature will ever eat anything raw because there is no nutrition of any kind available from raw foods.
Wow.
Nothing in nature, right down to the microbial level, will eat raw things. There is no nutrition that you can get from any raw food. You are starving your immune system. You are aiding and abetting the cancer every time you eat any raw food.
Holy crap. That's like incredibly radical statement in light of some
You
raw
can go to
anyway.
YouTube and you can watch my raw versus cooked debate.
Okay.
And if you want to know more about the difficulty with raw food and why no living thing eats raw food.
Well, okay. Well,
do you
I
think
guess
that there's something
animals
that eats raw
food?
I'm
well,
sorry,
don't
what?
Animals,
no, they don't.
They kill
no, I'm sorry, they
animals?
Don't. I understand
they
that
don't.
Most people think but it's simply not true. Let's start with my dairy goats or a cow. Have you ever seen a cow eat?
No.
They bite, swallow, bite, swallow. They don't even bother to chew, neither do my goats, because they get no nutrition of any kind from raw food. They bite and swallow, and all that raw food goes into their cooking pot, which they have inside their body. It's called a rumen.
Uh-huh.
And they cook their food for 4 to 6 hours at a fairly high temperature, and only when their food is cooked and fermented and broken down do they then cough it up and chew their food and chew their cud, because they only eat cooked food.
Okay.
And most of the really successful animals are ruminants, goats, sheep, cows, bison, elk, reindeer, antelope. Many,
so
many,
even,
many
so, I guess I'm
do
just,
their food in this way. Now, last
okay.
year, I was very privileged to have a veterinary student do her externship with me. And I said to her, you know, I understand about, like, forestomach fermentation and hindgut fermentation, which is what some other animals do, and caprophagy, which is where animals actually excrete the food, which they got no nutrition out of it, and then they let their feces ferment, and then they eat that. That's caprophagy. That's another way that animals do it, because you can't get any nutrition from raw food, so you have to do something. I said, well, what do horses do? I know they don't have a rumen. I know they don't do hindgut fermentation. I know they're not caprophages. What do they do? She said, well, first of all, you got to understand that 98% of the food you put in the front end of the horse comes right at the back end. That's why people love horse manure for their gardens, because it's so rich in nutrients, because the horses don't get any of it. And where the horses really get their nutrition value is from hay, which is dried food. There are five ways to cook food: heat, cold, dehydration, fermentation, and covering in oil.
Uh-huh.
But for anyone who has any real problem, I would never recommend juice of any kind or any kind of raw food.
Wow. Okay. I do know the other part of my diet is I don't eat any sugar or processed sugar, because I feel that that...
Those raw juices that you're doing are pure sugar.
They're pure sugar.
Pure
even
sugar.
If they're greens, mostly greens, but still.
They're pure sugar. Photosynthesis creates sugar. All you're getting from the plants is sugar when you're doing those green drinks.
Oh, my God. Okay.
How much meat do you eat?
I eat fish and... organic beef, I guess. I actually was craving it today. I guess I eat it. I eat fish fairly often, almost once a day. And then this meat.
Excellent.
Is okay. And then meat I eat, it varies. It's more like once or twice a month.
That sounds pretty reasonable. If you want to improve your immune system, though, I would say more, and your body already told you that, right?
Yeah, I mean, today I was really craving it, and I do brown rice, I do vegetables, which I steam or blanch.
Not good. Not good. They
not
need
good.
To be cooked, not steamed.
That's not cooking. Steaming's not cooking?
It's not cooking,
okay.
No, it's not. What kind of vegetables are we talking about here?
Zucchini,
Brussels
sprouts, broccoli,
live?
New York City.
Where do you live?
Manhattan.
Where do you live?
Manhattan, New York. Yeah.
Zucchini is not in our environment yet. No zucchini.
Okay.
Zucchini is being imported from Mexico, Florida, or California. It's not in your environment. It's not going to help your immune system.
Okay. So only stuff that's grown locally.
Well, I mean, if you're going to eat brown rice, you might as well, you know, follow the macrobiotic tenet, which is eat what's in season where you live. There's no better eating tenet that out there than eat what's in season where you live.
Yes, I was macrobiotic a little years ago. So it's a semi-basis for my eating.
They certainly would not agree with your eating zucchini now, would they?
I didn't realize that. I didn't research
it. Not just because it's not in season, but because zucchini is way too yin.
Way too yin?
Way too yin.
Okay.
Probiotic diet
like...
is the only diet that has been shown to reverse cancer. And it contains
really?
No raw food of any kind.
Okay. I don't remember how I find out if the yin-yang diet food, is that like the five elements, like Anne-Marie Colbin's cookbook?
Well, yeah. You know, yin is the dark part and yang is the bright part. Yin is the watery fluid part and yang is the dry part. So foods that are watery, like melons and tomatoes and summer squashes, are the yin foods. And foods that are tighter, like kale, would be more yang.
Mm-hmm.
And then we make kale even more yang, and we get the nutrition out of it by cooking it for at least an hour.
Okay. I crave kale, but I actually do a raw kale salad, but it's kind of massaged with salt and oil. And
how much kale do you eat at a single serving? Do you eat half of kale massaged with oil and salt?
Oh, I'd say a third. Maybe sometimes a half, yeah.
Be very surprised if you are. I've sat around people eating this, and the most they ever eat is 4 or 5 kale leaves. Which is a couple
of
ounces.
No, I eat like a half or a third. I do. I love it. I make a big giant bowl.
And if that's, if that's what you want to do, you certainly can. But I will only tell you that you will get 10 times more nutrition if you cook that kale. It's up to you. You can throw your nutrition away or you can actually get it.
Sure. Stay away from fruit.
Do indigenous people massage their kale with salt and oil?
I don't know.
No, because it's a crazy thing to do. I mean, it's good, and I'm not saying don't do it. Fine, you really like it. I got no problem with it. And you even want to dehydrate it, that's even better. Because now you're going to start to get some nutrition if you'll actually put it in the oven and dehydrate it. Because now you're going to break some cell walls. But after I made the raw versus cooked debate, which was a video that Brigitte Mars and I made for the purpose of making money, we were going to sell it. We went to Brigitte's house for a raw food meal, which included massaged kale. And I went with a friend who was a diabetic. And she's a type 1 diabetic, and she always measures her blood sugar before and after each meal. And the readings were identical. What does that mean? The entire meal and your blood sugar has not changed.
Okay. So it didn't register.
No food value, right?
No food value.
No food.
Okay.
No nourishment. Huh. And we're not talking a bowl of fruit here. We're talking about massaged kale with the oil, just like you're talking about, and a very fancy meal. Brigitte went to a lot of trouble to make a beautiful meal for us, and I'm very thankful. But, in fact, my friend almost died. Because even though she went home and we cooked some food for her and got some food value into her and got some insulin into her, she nonetheless overnight slipped into a semi-coma, and I wound up having to call 911 the next morning because she had eaten raw food for dinner.
Okay. It's odd. I have a friend with MS who swears that she does like a of blended green veggie thing for breakfast and lunch and then cooked meat, and she feels well and better and energized and less pain than in any other time.
It's difficult to talk about someone who isn't around. I mean, perhaps that before she was eating a diet that didn't include fruits and vegetables or didn't include meat. And so we're comparing an excellent diet as compared to a really not so good diet. So, I mean, she feels better than before, but I don't know what before is, and I doubt if you know what before is.
She feels very well.
And
she doesn't get sick.
Something
she feels very well.
That is scientifically shown to be true, and we need to all understand this. When we eat raw food because we are not getting enough nourishment, our brain starts to act as though we are starving because the brain says, wow, nowhere near enough nourishment is coming in here. I'm just going to set us up for starvation because starvation can be really painful. And so we're going to counter this by producing heroin. And I do not mean this symbolically. I don't mean this metaphorically. I mean this literally, physically. The brain produces heroin when you eat raw food. Now, how do people who are taking heroin feel?
They feel great.
Why, it's addictive, right? They say, I never felt better, don't they?
Yes.
So when you have somebody who's on raw food who says, I never felt better, you have to understand that they are heroin addicts.
Okay. Well, all right.
They don't
feel
well because they're getting nourished, but they feel well because their brain is drugging them.
Right. It's interesting because one of my friends just started taking this micronutrient supplement, True Hope, because their theory is that we don't get enough nutrition, so it's like mega doses of vitamins that are supposedly helping people with bipolar and ADD and depression. But that's their come from, that we don't have enough
nutrition. No study of any kind has ever found that taking any vitamin supplement in small or large doses can prevent or cure any human disease. As a matter of fact, in the largest study done to date, which was a meta-study done in Denmark looking at the supplementation habits of 8 million people, from as young as 1 to as old as 90, they found that people who took supplements had as much acute disease and as much chronic disease as people who didn't take supplements, that they lived about the same amount of time with these exceptions. And the exceptions were that every single supplement caused a shortening of life, and the greater the amount of vitamin in the supplement, the shorter the life.
Wow. Okay.
Now, if you think that your food doesn't have nutrition, I'm here to tell you that your food has got plenty of nutrition, but you are not accessing it. You are treating your food as though it had no nutrition, and so it has no nutrition. You actually start cooking your food. You actually start making soups. You will find that your food has lots and lots of nutrition. And, of course, are you drinking nourishing herbal infusions?
No. I'm drinking water.
I don't allow my apprentices to drink water. We do not drink water because water has no vitamins, no minerals, and no protein.
Okay.
Water is a complete waste to drink, and I see more people creating health problems for themselves by drinking water than just about any other beverage.
Okay. So herbal-infused water.
You have already drunk your quart of infusion, and you're still thirsty, and you want to drink some water, not a problem. But first you have to drink your quart of infusion.
Okay. And
you can find information on making nourishing herbal infusions in every single one of my books, on YouTube's, information all over the place. You can see me and my wonderful granddaughter, Monica Jean, making nourishing herbal infusions and hear us talking about them. They're very easy to make. You make them yourself at home. You make them each evening, and you drink it the next day.
Okay.
And you get lavish amounts of nutrition from the nourishing herbal infusions. Just to give you some numbers here so we can throw a few numbers around so that you can see what I'm talking about. A quart of nettle infusion contains 3,000 milligrams of calcium, 860 milligrams of magnesium, large amount of chlorophyll, 4 milligrams of chromium, 13 of cobalt, 42 of iron, 450 of phosphorus, 1,750 of potassium, 5 of zinc. The entire B-complex of vitamins, including very high thiamine and riboflavin, and carotenes, there is the equivalent of 16,000 international units of vitamin A. Nettle leaves and stalk also supply niacin, 10% protein, manganese, selenium, silicon, tin, vitamin C, vitamin D, and vitamin K. Do you think you need to take a pill if you're drinking nourishing herbal infusions?
No, that sounds great. I guess...
When you buy nettle, it will cost you less than $1 a day to get this kind of nutrition, which is incredible, optimum nutrition, whereas I'm going to guess that the pills you're talking about are probably going to cost you at least twice that, huh?
Oh, yeah. No, they're very expensive. Well, I know that I've always felt, I don't feel really satisfied when I eat, and I have had digestive constipation problems and chronic depression. So I'm happy to eat differently. I keep trying to find a way to eat that feels good for me, and I do work out a lot and put a lot of energy out. Physical energy.
You will be so thrilled once you start working with these nourishing herbal infusions. And
okay,
I make it
and
poured
then
in the evening. I let it steep overnight. The next morning I strain it, refrigerate it. If you want to, if you're going out and about, throw some with some ice into a container that you can take with you. And that basically nourishing herbal infusion is what I drink. It's my primary drink. It's been my primary drink for more than 25 years.
Okay. And
entire time, I have not taken any supplement of any kind.
Oh, wow. Okay. I do also do green tea, but I'm not. How do you feel about green tea?
Green tea is certainly fine. Not a problem there.
Okay. So where do I find a list of, is it in your book about eating what foods are seasonal, local, or just research that? Because I'm guessing that's what I need to eat.
I would say, it's hard for me to believe that you, who seem to be pretty together, would be so out of sync with what is being grown that you wouldn't know. I mean, maybe that is what you're telling me. Wow, I can't tell what's local. I don't know what's going on outside. I'm, locked up in my apartment, and I'm an idiot. But that's not who you're coming across to me as.
No, I don't know those things. I will have to research it. I which is fine. I just don't know. I'm not in touch. I don't garden, and it's certainly a.
But what I'm
it's a symptom
is
of how I grew
most
up. But
of those things have a country of origin on them. Yes.
Possibly. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Most every fruit and vegetable that's sold in supermarkets now has a sticker on it. Yes.
Yeah.
And
well,
most of those
a lot of
give you the country of origin. And again, you can think about it. You know that this is just the very beginning of June and that it takes a while for zucchini to grow and that there's no way that anybody in this climate could have even started growing those zucchinis until a couple of weeks ago because we were still having frosts. And these are frost-sensitive plants. So one way to find out about this is to look and see what's inexpensive. Things that are local are going to be inexpensive. Things that are coming from far away are going to be more expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one way.
Okay.
Another way is to go to a farmer's market. And I know there's farmer's markets in Manhattan.
Yes.
And then you can talk to the farmers themselves and say, did you buy anything from out of the country? Is all of this stuff you've grown? And even if you don't buy it from them, at least you'll be able to see what is fresh and local right now.
By going
to the farmer's market, because you'll be there with the farmers.
Right, that's a great idea. I can do that.
Zucchini in and of itself has very little nutrition.
Okay.
It's very low on the nutrient chart. Now, Center for Science in the Public Interest, CSPI.org, puts out some really great charts. And I have a chart here called The Healthiest Vegetables. And I'm just going to go down this so that you can have some idea of what the very healthiest vegetables are. Starting at the top, chard, kale. This is cooked. Cooked chard, cooked kale, cooked spinach. Collard greens, cooked and or frozen. Brussels sprouts, pumpkin. All right, cooked, cooked. Broccoli, cooked. Sweet potato, baked. All right, now raw spinach. So which was better, right? They give these the plants a number, and the number is they add up how much percentage of vitamins and minerals it has. So what if it has, say, for instance, the broccoli has 51% of the carotenoids you need, 159% of the vitamin K, 97% of vitamin C, 10% of folate, 9% of fiber, 7% of potassium, and 4% of calcium, that gives it a score of 339 points. So just as comparison, cooked spinach has a score of 925, and raw spinach has a score of 278.
Okay.
So you're getting what happens?
Yeah.
When you cook a food, you the nutrition. When you eat it raw, you throw the nutrition away. Again, broccoli, cooked broccoli, the number is 339, and raw broccoli, the number is 160.
Okay. Are you a proponent of no gluten or limited gluten? Because that's, I guess, part of my diet is no
celiac
wheat, no
disease?
Sugar.
You have celiac disease?
No.
Then I think it's an absurdity to avoid gluten.
Okay. Okay. Not something you do. Okay.
I don't think that it makes any sense. Avoiding gluten, really avoiding gluten, means that you can only eat at home and that you must buy only unprepared foods. Because gluten is in virtually every prepared food that you eat that is not at your own home. So if you're going to avoid gluten, you can't ever eat out.
Okay.
Now, that's not much
fun. No, it's not much fun. And dairy, or I mean, I tend to do goat cheese
dairy
and goat
is
yogurt.
The mother, of course we want to eat dairy.
Okay. Well, okay. And
do you have a problem with your mother?
No.
Well, I can only, I only see that milk hating is mother hating.
Oh, gosh. That's tragic.
It's just mothers, right?
Yeah, I hear you. You're radical, but you make sense.
radical means?
Oh, radix
means root. A person who is radical is a person who is rooted.
Great. Awesome.
So radical because I am very rooted. I am rooted in what is real and what is true and not a bunch of nonsense.
Right. I hear you. Well, I did feel better when I stopped being macrobiotic and I added animal protein at least once a day, and I felt so much better. It was remarkable. So I feel like I've had chronic depression my whole life, and is there something specific that I can eat to address that, or just changing my diet in general to have more nutrients will address it?
I had a course at the Wise Woman University called Drink Your Way to Health with Nourishing Herbal Infusions, and it's quite amazing to see the number of people who write in and say, since I've started drinking Nourishing Herbal Infusions, I have stopped taking my depression medication. Since I've started drinking Nourishing Herbal Infusions, I have halved my diabetes medication. Since I've started drinking Nourishing Herbal Infusions, I don't take my anti-anxiety medication anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So I can only say that my experience of suggesting and using Nourishing Herbal Infusions over a period of more than 25 years is that everyone thrives on them and that they help to restore your natural optimum health and your natural optimum diet, and that the human being is not designed to think about what to eat. Our brains simply skid out when we start thinking about what to eat. So what I suggest is, rather than thinking about what to eat, is that we make and drink our nourishing herbal infusions a quart a day, and we provide ourselves with whole foods and a variety of whole foods, and then let our bodies tell us what we need to eat.
Okay. And so seeds and nuts and whatever's in season, actually I'm guessing sprouted seeds and nuts, or is that not?
Never sprouted, no. Sprouts are lethal.
Oh, sprouts are lethal because they're raw.
There are foods that kill people, and sprouts are one of them. As a matter of fact, the Center for Disease Control says that more people die as a result of food poisoning from sprouts than virtually any other reason in the United States. And this is because of bacterial contamination. Secondly, sprouts are baby plants, and because they have to be protected while they are sprouting, they produce carcinogenic chemicals. Alfalfa sprouts produce a chemical that is 10,000 times more carcinogenic than any man-made chemical.
Oh, my God. Okay.
And this is why, if you were a gardener, you would see that no bird, no insect, nothing of any kind in nature will eat a sprout. Furthermore, there is no indigenous group of people anywhere that eat sprouts, with the exception of Chinese people. And I always say we have to understand that the Chinese diet is a little strange because they have had, episodes of China where millions of people have starved to death through lack of food. So they have made some food choices in response to starvation, not in response to what's a really healthy thing to eat. And the Chinese do eat mung beans that have been sprouted, but they will only eat them if two requirements are met. One, it must be beyond the sprouting stage. It must have a true leaf. And two, it must be cooked.
Mm-hmm.
So even people who are starving will not eat raw sprouts.
Okay. So
because
soaking,
they know better.
I was been recently soaking my raw almonds because I like them better. They're chewier and softer, and people call that sprouting.
You never eat nuts raw.
Oh, but you never eat raw, so okay.
You would never eat raw nuts. Raw nuts contain anti-nutritional compounds, which leach on to vitamin B12. They actually fuse with the vitamin B12 and make it unavailable to the body. They prevent the body from utilizing calcium. They prevent the body from utilizing selenium. Basically, raw nuts make sure that your immune system doesn't work.
Okay. Okay. So this whole alkaline acid thing is not relevant?
Balderdash.
It's balderdash.
Acid alkaline balance of your blood is so critical to your ability to be alive and to remain conscious that there is a gland, actually a pair of glands, the parathyroid glands, which do nothing but measure the acidity, alkalinity of your blood. That's
okay.
All they do. And if your blood is too acidic, then they suggest that some calcium be removed from your bones to alkalinize it, but nothing that you eat changes the acid alkaline of your blood.
What changes it?
Your mood.
Oh. Okay.
So I'm going to suggest to you what we suggest to the apprentices, and that is fake it. I want you to get up. I want you to plaster a smile on your face, whether you feel it or not. And I want you to stop saying you're depressed.
Mm-hmm.
Just stop. Just stop being a depressed person. Is it helping you? Is it helping you to say that I'm a depressed person? I've been depressed all my life?
Nope.
So why don't you just stop? You would be surprised. Pasting a smile on your face this morning will do, because it will actually make the parts of your brain that produce feel-good hormones start to operate, and you will actually feel good because you faked a smile.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
right. Last thing at night, if you need a little something to go to sleep on, are there any movies that you find funny?
Yeah.
Watch a movie that makes you laugh before you go to sleep. Personally, okay. I read the Funny Times.
Okay.
It's very important to have laughter. I am certainly a big fan of the comics.
Okay.
I want to laugh out loud. Montauk Chia has an entire book on the inner smile.
Yes, I did that for a while.
Well, go back to it. If you worked on that program, you had to laugh for what, 5 minutes every morning?
Yeah, I wasn't laughing in the morning. No, I don't remember that being part of it. I was just doing smiling into the organs and doing the sounds.
Well, yeah, and it starts. You started in the middle of the book. The beginning of the book is you laugh out loud for 5 minutes.
Okay.
Before you start smiling with your organs, because smiling with your organs isn't going to do you any good if you don't really know how to laugh.
Okay.
Right?
Okay. Yeah.
So give yourself that opportunity. You can say, I was a person who used to be depressed, if that's an important, thing to claim for yourself.
Okay.
But again, to me, that's just kind of self-talk that drives us down.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I guess the whole, it was go into your feelings, feel your feelings, go through them, blah, 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 all that, so that they don't get stuck. So I was going into my feelings, and my feelings were sad a lot.
But sad is not depressed, hello?
No, sad is not depressed. Sad is an okay feeling, yeah.
But
yeah.
You told me I'm a depressed person. I've been depressed all my life.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Those are the words
yeah.
you used.
Yeah, I feel sad.
Hey, you know what? There's a lot to feel sad about.
Yes, true.
I feel sad that an American woman is raped every 4 minutes. That makes me not just sad, but angry,
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right? I feel, pretty upset that one woman dies every minute of every day in pregnancy or childbirth. And for every woman who dies, another 20 are injured or suffer infection or disease. Every minute of every day on this planet, 20 women are injured, suffer infection or disease from sexual behavior foisted on them or from pregnancy or childbirth. Now, that's enough to make anybody sad, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
sad is a very appropriate reaction to what's going on this planet. However, I do suggest to most women that after you've spent enough time in sad, get mad.
Mm-hmm.
Get mad. Get mad about something. Get
yeah.
mad about infant mortality. Get mad about rape, and then do something about it. Don't, we can be sad about everything, but we have to be mad about one thing so we can take effective action.
Yes,
And that's the real
agree.
Cure for depression, isn't it? Is to get mad.
Depression
is just anger that we have turned against ourselves.
Yeah, and I guess I just also have, I'm dealing with grief, and I'm suggested that
and
it was complicated
grief.
Grief
is not depression either.
It's not. No, it's not. It's grief.
It's grief. And you,
yeah.
I think you said you lost your mom.
Yeah.
And I know that for myself, when my mom died, I felt like a balloon whose cord had been cut. And I had not realized how much that umbilical cord was still between me and my mom and how much grounding she was doing for me and how much I really depended on her. We had times, when we had difficulty and we had times when we had less difficulty. But I was rather surprised when she died at, how boo, what came up. And for me, my grief basically slowed me down. And rather than kicking myself in the butt for being slowed down, I said, you are honoring your mom by being slower. Sometimes I would just want to sit in my chair.
Yeah.
And I would say, this is how you're grieving, Susan. This is how you're grieving your mom. It's okay to just sit here.
Yeah. Yeah, that seemed to be forced upon me. I just needed to slow down. I was so grieving. I need to take action now. I think I'm in transition. I need to take action and back in the world and earn a living and work and take care of my health, which so I got all nervous about the cervical cancer stuff. And I have to do something now to be in action. And I am definitely more motivated and definitely have the anger and wanting to just stop. And some of my intuition is just to stop, just get up and do it. Like, this is me. It's the only thing in my way at this point is me. That's all I can tell. And I don't want to do that anymore. And it seems to be my choice. So.
You are a brave and powerful woman, and I feel very honored that you are talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for sharing this journey. As one of my mentors often said, when any one of us do this work, we are doing it for everyone.
Yeah.
So this is not just about you. There's lots and lots of people listening who are really relating to what we're talking about. Lots and lots of people who are grieving, who have lost a mom, a dad, a sister, a brother, even a son or a daughter.
Yeah.
And I've been talking in the show. I was just at in Wisconsin at the Midwest Women's Herbal Conference, and my friend Aviva Rahm, MD, was there, and she was talking about the diagnostic manual for physicians, and that grief after 3 months is a pathology that needs to be treated. And she was so outraged at this that she said she wanted to tear the book into shreds.
Yeah, I know it.
She said, how can we expect people to stop grieving after 3 months? This is absurd.
Yeah.
For many people, in fact, and I don't want to scare you with this, but for many people, in fact, it was somebody that you've been the caretaker of, it actually takes almost a year for you to really believe the person is dead, and then the grieving can almost start after a year. And it's not that you haven't grieved during that year, but there's something that happens at the end of that year, and many cultures recognize this. That kind of drops you down into an even deeper grief, although it's shorter.
Oh, yeah, I had that. I felt it. The year was up, and I dropped down into a place. I know it. I felt that.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, I'm still honoring. I like the place that I'm honoring. I'm honoring her, and I'm just doing my work.
What was her name?
Yeah. Evelyn.
What was her name? I'm sorry?
Evelyn.
Evelyn. Evelyn, let's send a heartfelt hug out to Evelyn. I'm sure she's eavesdropping on us right now.
Oh, I totally believe so. She was a strong, wild woman and wonderful being. Absolutely.
Yes.
my best friend, yeah.
Yeah. So let me just summarize. The human brain is not designed to think about what we eat. Surround yourself with good food and then just let yourself eat any of that. Make your nourishing herbal infusions, put them in the refrigerator, drink a quart of nourishing herbal infusion a day, and I think you're doing great. Drink green tea and get some more cooked food in your diet, and you are not too old. My goodness, I'm only 20 years older than I am, and my immune system works really, really, really well. So, you know, unfortunately, medical doctors in this country are not used to seeing healthy people. And when they get
no,
a healthy person, they just don't know what to do with
it. Right. Ah. And I just want to clarify, do you stay away from sugar, like white sugar, or you don't?
I'm sorry. I'm going to have to break this up just right now. I'm so sorry. But you can call back again next week because we have someone waiting and we only have about 5.5 minutes left on the entire show. So I want to get that one person squeezed in. Susan doesn't think you should avoid sweeteners. Is that right, Susan?
That's true.
Is that right?
I do not think you need to avoid anything.
Okay, great. Thank you. Got it. Thank you so much. Blessings to you.
You are so welcome. Blessings. And let's hear from our last questioner here.
Okay, the person in the 260. Area, do you have a question for Susan? Hello? Can you hear us? Oh, no, I'm sorry. They hung up.
They hang up. Oh, alas. Well,
Yeah, alas and alack.
I have taken such a long time with her, but I thought that the issues, as I said.
She's back unmuted, and if you want to finish that discussion about sugar, that would get us through to the end. We have about 4.5 minutes.
Okay, do we want to talk a little bit about sugar then?
Sure.
All right. Basically, whatever we eat, the liver turns into sugar. Sugar is what your body runs on. It's kind of like saying, oh, do you avoid gasoline in your car?
No.
And I was just listening to a talk today about the actual mechanics of photosynthesis. And it says, well, actually what the plants do is they take the carbon dioxide. I had always thought that they took the carbon dioxide and broken oxygen off that. But what they do is they take the carbon dioxides and they glue them together to make sugar by kicking the oxygen out of water and then being left with the hydrogen. And the hydrogen glues the carbon dioxides together to make sugar. So the plants make sugar. And all plants, this lecturer said, basically are sources of sugar. That if you say, well, I'm not going to eat sugar, then you have to eat only protein.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're eating any plants or any fruits, you are eating sugar.
Right, I guess that would be too.
I think that what you mean is you're not eating white refined sugar.
Yes, like I would.
And that you're not eating high fructose corn syrup.
Right, but honey, agave, molasses.
You got a gripe against them?
No, those would be good sugars, I'm guessing.
Okay. It was a little unclear from what you were saying. I thought you said you were avoiding sugar.
No, well, I was avoiding definitely the white processed high fructose corn syrup, but I was avoiding sugar because years ago I was diagnosed with systemic candida, and they told me to, you know, really take out sugar, even fructose and fruit sugar.
There is no such thing.
Okay.
That's like being diagnosed with Smicmuckawicky.
Okay.
This is a totally made-up diagnosis.
Okay.
And even if there was such a thing, eliminating sugar would do nothing because, as I said, your body produces sugar.
Okay. Well, I know I had a lot of symptoms at the time, but I was, you know, brain fog and fatigue and
all of the symptoms of supposed candida overgrowth are general symptoms: tiredness, headache, lack of focus, back pain. These are actually the symptoms of being alive.
Well, bloating and gas and all that. I mean, I was
bloating and
like
gas
16.
And all that can come from eating raw food.
Okay.
I don't know what
all
you
right.
were eating it, but it certainly has nothing to do with a supposed candida overgrowth. And if there was a supposed candida overgrowth, the only way to deal with it is to eat lots of fermented foods.
Okay, they told me not to eat fermented foods.
Understand.
Okay. Okay. Well, I'm definitely going to look at your...
At the Midwest Women's Herbal Conference, we were talking about cholesterol, and someone said that she had just read a book, and the MD who wrote it said that blaming heart attack on cholesterol is like blaming fires on the firefighters. It is true that the firefighters always show up and there's a fire, but they didn't cause it. It is true that candida may show up in your gut, but it's there because the other gut flora have been harmed and killed. And therefore, we need to improve gut flora with yogurt and a variety of other fermented and moldy things. And I've had people who've been on a candida diet for 20 years and not gotten any better start eating a moldy diet, and they're better in 3 days.
Wow.
Blessings, everybody. Thanks for joining Susan Weed here at Blog Talk Radio, where we are reweaving the healing cloak of the ancients and reestablishing herbal medicine as people's medicine. Join me next week, Tuesday, or come at the archive and listen in anytime you want to. Thanks so much, everybody. Thank you, Justine. As always,
thank
a wonderful
you,
job of moderating.
Thank you, Susan. Love you. Good night.
I love you, yeah, honey. Good night.
You.
Good night, everybody. Mama,